Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you're tuned in to the show via the National Indigenous Radio Service, or if you're listening on the web 98.9fm.com.au, welcome to you as well. It's great to have your company. Now, last night, some really exciting news broke down in New South Wales. The only man ever accused of the Bowravel murders, so that's three Aboriginal children who were murdered on Bowravel Mission in 1990 to 1991, Evelyn Greenup, Clinton Speedy Giroux and Colleen Walker. And it's now up to the Criminal Court of Appeal to decide if that fresh evidence that the police have put forth to the Attorney General will actually go to a retrial. So it's come after a very long time of campaigning, a long period of protest by the families, and it's a really exciting development. I wanted to acknowledge it because hopefully we'll play a special on it next Monday, talking specifically about the Bowravel murders, and I think that'll be really interesting and really important to follow. It's the saddest case I've ever heard of, and I think once you hear the testimony of the families, you can't turn away. Now, we're going to change subject a little bit. Yesterday, I spoke to a climate scientist, Donna Green, who is working at UNSW in the Climate Research Centre down there. She previously worked for CSIRO, and she's one of the few and the first scientists to actually look at the impact climate change will specifically have on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And she started it around 10 years ago and hardly anyone was talking about it. But she now says that you can't actually look at any area of our lives and Aboriginal affairs and not see how climate change is going to compound the problems and the difficulties. So it's something that we have to continue thinking about and talking about. And I think it's important too, we've had a lot of climate campaigners on our program, which has been very important, but it's also important to get some of that climate science and find out what exactly is going to be happening. So here's my chat with Dr. Donna Green. I hope you enjoy it. First, going to ask you your background and your title and I guess how you became interested in this particular mode of study.
Okay. So my title is a senior researcher at the Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. I fell upon this area. I actually was interested in environmental science, which was my original qualification, and then went overseas to look at energy resource use. And through that, when I came back to Australia, I realised there seemed to be a disconnect between energy policy and climate change.
Yeah, right.
So that's how I got into this area, right at the beginning.
And I guess a lot of your research has focused on Aboriginal populations as well. Did you find that was, when you started to research, that was another gap, I guess, in climate change debates and policy arenas?
I'd say gap was an understatement. because of my experience in the US, specifically in California, where the environmental justice movement is quite strong. I had a lot of exposure to different Indigenous communities who were working against mining or, you know, the fossil fuel corporations. And so when I came back to Australia, I thought if I spent a bit of time up north, I'd be able to find people who understood these issues within the Indigenous communities.
Right.
And also were possibly linking them to climate. And I thought, well, if I keep looking, I'll find them. And I didn't. So at the time, I was employed by the CSIRO. And they very kindly basically let me have a bit of free rein to try and work up north to start making these connections. So that's really where it all started. It wasn't a deliberate intention to get into this space. It was more actually wanting to link up with people that I then discovered at the time weren't there. And this was sort of in the early 2000s, I'd say.
Yeah, right.
So I spent a good bit of time just really trying to build some connections up and make some awareness so Indigenous people could actually take these issues on themselves, because, you know, that's not my role, but trying to facilitate the application of what we know about climate science and how that might affect communities and what they might want to do about it. That's something I can help with.
Did you find that maybe they might have had an understanding about the effects of climate change, but obviously not in the language of Western science?
Absolutely. I mean, many people who are living close to country, or even if they're living in urban areas, but they go back home occasionally, have a very deep knowledge of what country should look like, how culture should work with culture. Culture should work with country, and very broadly defined ideas of Indigenous health and well-being. So you can't disconnect an individual or a community's health from the health of their country. So what people would be telling me from, you know, the Kimberley, across the north or into the Torres Strait, is that they were finding things weren't right. So they would report differences in weather patterns or a disconnect between maybe a particular fish that they would normally catch and an association with a tree that would be flowering at the same time. So they would see difference in weather patterns, and that's many of the things that, you know, a climate scientist might be looking for, to see changes in seasons, but not in the language that maybe someone who was trained in Western science would say it.
I guess the other area is also Western science. Did you find that there was sort of that roadblock ahead of you in being able to start to look at how Aboriginal populations are more vulnerable? Was there sort of a barriers in place on the other side, more of a Western scientific perspective, that they just hadn't begun thinking about the impacts on Aboriginal people?
That's a good question. You're quite right. I mean, literally, it was a missing block. Where one of the earliest pieces of research I did was to try and put the Torres Strait Islands actually on a map, in a literal sense, for the CSIRO, because
really?
The way they were looking at climate in that region, the Torres Strait Islands were essentially considered too small to be seen. And that's, you know, to be fair, in a downscale climate model, you've got a region of, you know, a couple of hundred K across. You're not going to see a small island. But because of that, no one really noticed that they were there and that people didn't need to consider climate impacts on those islands. So that was...
So basically, literally, the Torres Strait weren't on the map at the CSIRO. It's quite amazing, well, even a bit shocking.
Yeah, and it wasn't... there was nothing deliberate about it. It literally was just an ignorance of trying to cover the biggest, most important areas first. And for any country, that's the major cities. That's their priority. And then they work out from there. So it's not like they were deliberately leaving them off, but no one there really alerted them to the fact that they would need to consider different specific vulnerable groups.
Yeah, right.
And Indigenous people across the north potentially were vulnerable to impacts, and certainly at that time hadn't had any targeted information that was presented to them in a usable form. And I think that's probably, hopefully that was one of the useful roles I did, is just bring people together and try and work out what they needed and what at that time SIRO could do to provide that information and help with that information sharing. And I have to say that probably links in with some of the information your listeners heard to recently. That was the SIRO group that recently got a number of redundancies. So they've been slowly whittling away at that the climate scientists were doing good stuff. I got out there, got out from that group a decade ago, but it is sad to see that, you know, some work where they have flexibility doing stuff with people that really needed it are being cut.
It's really sad, because you even look at it from a mainstream sense, and when you talk about the redundancies, obviously climate science just isn't valued even in mainstream Australia. So I can imagine climate science from an Aboriginal perspective is even less valued. I think we have a problem with even looking and valuing that science in the first place.
Well, the difficulty, I think, for many people is realising that there are a number of different types of scientists that work in climate. So if there were adequate numbers of people who were trained up, skilled, and could work with people both in climate science, so that basically is trying to work out how bad the problem will be, to climate impact and adaptation scientists who work out what that number will be and translate that into meaningful terms to lay people, to understand what the problem will be for them at their particular location and that point in time, and the kind of activities that people can take to reduce the problem. So, for example, if you live near the coast, you might need to do a planned build further uphill or away from a river. And then finally, also the people who work in mitigation. So that's reducing the amount of carbon that goes into the atmosphere to reduce the problem in the first place.
Yeah,
now,
right.
To me, those are all inherently linked jobs. And maybe what SIRO was saying was, or the bosses at SIRO were saying, is you need less people working on describing the problem because we know the problem. But we were so massively underinvested in all three of those areas.
Yeah, right.
Reducing one is just going to reduce the investment in all three down the track. And I think that's where many people were very, very upset, because we're certainly not flush with climate scientists, and many of them go overseas anyway. So we're just encouraging that flow, unfortunately.
Oh, it's incredibly scary when you consider it, because I did want to ask you about projections, and I think it's hard for a layman to understand sort of that actual science that you're talking about, and particularly projections. I was just wondering, how confident can we be, particularly in, I guess, climate change projections from the IPCC? And I was wondering whether you can talk about, I guess, those global emissions maps and projections, because I think people get really buried down in a lot of this data and they don't actually know what it means.
I guess there's two answers. I'm going to give the simple one first, which is the problem's bad. Yeah. The IPCC is quite conservative, and when they start talking about 99 or 95% certainty about a projection they're making, you know, we could go into the subtleties of the science, but that baffles people, and it's unnecessary. You don't, if you need a heart operation, you don't go and ask in great detail for the heart doctor's procedures, methods, and, you know, whether he's considered this or that option. You have to inherently trust people who have been working in this area for decades. And, you know, if everything that's coming out consistently is getting more and more certain about these projections, they're matching with the observations and the record, you know, I mean, my suggestion is just really to actually take what the IPCC is saying with the projections as read, and really try and put some pressure on the people that can make a difference to start reducing our carbon emissions.
Yeah, right.
I think some people actually sort of feel like they need to understand the science.
Yeah.
And certainly if you want to, you can, but you don't really, you know, going back to the heart doctor analogy, you don't really need to understand the intricacies of the medicine and the procedure to believe that doctor is doing the right thing. That's what they're trained to do.
I guess we live in that anti-scientific climate where we're sort of conditioned to disbelieve things that are told to us, I guess. We don't want to take things on face value. Do you think that's part of the problem, maybe? We just, and I guess because we all have sort of a say in it, we're all very vulnerable to it as well, we don't want to believe it?
Definitely we don't want to believe it, because we all have to make big changes in our lives.
Yeah, I think that's part of the
problem. Be less wasteful. So it's encouraging to think that maybe, you know, they're wrong or they don't know what they're talking about. I think possibly what one of the problems is this term skeptic that's been bandied about recently. I would say any good scientist is a skeptic. You want to doubt and you want to test people's hypotheses. It's very different to a denialist. And the climate denialists have been proven time and time again to be funded by the fossil fuel lobby.
Yeah.
They've got a lot of money in the, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and they have for decades to try and put out misinformation and trying to pull apart or confuse arguments that climate scientists are making. So I think that's complicated the issue. I think probably scientists are seen as fairly, you know, quiet, non-showy people by average general population. You know, they don't necessarily have a particular vested interest like a politician or, you know. So in that sense, I think what has happened is a lot of this denialist message over the years has been affected, and it's suggested that there is actually, you know, another side that climate scientists maybe don't all agree, which is not true at all, or that the science is very uncertain, which also is not true at all. I would love it to be different, and in fact, I really would, because even if climate change isn't happening, the policies we should put in place to live more sustainably and more harmoniously with our ecosystems would be good anyway.
Yeah.
It's just unfortunate.
It's really sad.
It's very likely that the climate change signal we're seeing is happening, and we absolutely have to do something about it as fast as we can. And the major frustration I have is there's so many solutions that we should have put in years ago, we certainly could put in today, and that will have massive implications to reducing the problem, and we're just not doing it fast enough. And that's one thing that upsets me. There's no problem with the technical solution. The barriers are political and social.
Yeah,
and that's something we really need to emphasise now.
Yeah, definitely. And I was reading a bit of your report you did a couple of years ago, which specifically, I guess, looked at the tropical north and the impact climate change is going to have on Aboriginal communities up there.
Mm.
And you talk a lot about, you know, obviously these are very scary projections in themselves, but there's also scarier, I guess, regional projections, particularly looking at North Australia. So there's going to be sort of greater, not only just sea level rises, but things around evaporation, monsoons, changes in monsoons, increases in tropical cyclones in intensity, and also obviously temperature rises. So I guess we only think of I know that I think when I think of climate change, I think of sea level rises, but it actually goes much deeper than that. Can you tell me a little bit about those individual changes, particularly that are going to affect the tropical north and particularly Aboriginal communities?
Yeah, sure. So when you hear about climate change, frequently hear about average temperature change, and some of the things you pointed to there are the extremes. And unfortunately, the extremes can make a real difference on human health or on an ecosystem, as we've seen recently in the Great Barrier Reef. If you warm the sea surface temperature, corals bleach. In northern Australia, obviously, because the percentage of Indigenous people is much higher than in the south, you're likely to see more people impacted. But also those ecosystems or the country that, you know, people connect to are very closely tied in with a big monsoonal system, for example. So if that rain that is meant to fall at a certain time, you know, give or take a couple of days, changes significantly, it has a significant flow-on effect for the ecosystems, the plants and animals that survive on that rain, and then obviously consequently on the people. And that's what we're starting to see. There's less certainty, for example, with rainfall than temperature change. But you can have the same amount of rain but falling at different times.
Right.
And that can be very difficult for ecosystems because if they're used to holding on for the dry season until the rains come, and that system shifts significantly, so you get more intense rain and later in the season, many ecosystems can't manage that, or you get massive amounts of runoff and flooding. So even though the average rain in a year may be more or less the same, the distribution can make a big difference. So that would be one example of an extreme. The other would be with temperature, which is much more certain. We think we're going to see more heat waves. So that's sort of a run of hot nights and hot days. That's a really big problem with human health because many older people and kids don't do very well in a heat wave. What our body needs is to be able to cool down at night, and normally you get a regular cycle of a hot day and a cooler night. If you get a heat wave where you get temperatures over a certain amount for a couple of days, you start to see a lot more people coming into hospital with heart disease, with respiratory, those kinds of, or heat stress, health problems. And that's a real problem in the north because the infrastructure is not so developed, so it's much harder for communities, if you're living remotely, to get back into, get public health or to get into a big hospital. If, for example, there's a flood and the road is cut off,
you have
to get medevaced out. You know, there's limited air services. Unfortunately, also telecoms frequently goes down, so you can't even let people know to come and get you. So all of those sorts of things are associated with these changes and extremes in northern Australia.
So it's not even just it's the continual hot days. It's just the different ways they form. And I guess when you see it that way, because I guess a lot of people see things from an anecdotal point of view, they'll look out the window and they'll say, well, it wasn't that hot today. It was hotter, you know, last week. I think it's very hard for us to perceive how that could happen when you're looking at those patterns. Is that part of the problem?
Yes, you're right. It's very difficult. And you know, anecdotally right now in Sydney, everyone's loving the fact that it's still warm, except it's almost winter. up north, it's difficult because there are variations, natural variations in weather patterns, which is what you see out the window. But what climate scientists look for are those long-term changes.
Yeah.
And that's why you hear people talking about averages. So, for example, the projection of those long-term changes in the north is suggesting that, for example, Darwin, I think, from memory, a conservative estimate, maybe in about 20 years' time, is the majority of their days will be over 35 degrees.
That's scary. It's
already so hot, and it's a coastal area, which suggests that really that wouldn't be an area where the temperature would increase that much because it's cooled by those coastal breezes. So central Australia is, looking that it's going to be baking in the not too distant future, and it's already hot.
And
so it's difficult in that sense because you can't necessarily understand what that will be like until you have it, and then it's too late. And it's complexified by the fact that human beings can survive with a certain temperature, but you've got to then think about, well, what's the humidity at the same time? If you've ever been in Darwin when it's, you know, really building up, that's very difficult for the human body to actually cool itself down enough. You know, you need to be in the shade, you need to drink lots of water, you need to have cool clothes. Ideally, you've got the wind cooling you down. And if you don't have any of those things, at a certain point, your body literally cannot cool itself down fast enough. And so that's one of the things that human health practitioners are looking at is, you know, which areas of Australia will we really have to start worrying if temperatures and humidities increase, because people will not be able to cool themselves down enough, and you'll start to see lots of people coming into hospital if there's a heat wave.
And anything I know in a lot of Aboriginal communities, and I'm thinking of, you know, people living around Darwin, I mean, there might be a case where they are forced off their land. I mean, that seems like a very extreme example, but is it fast becoming a reality if those temperatures begin to go like that. Like, I can just see we fought so hard for native title rights, for example, and land rights.
Oh, absolutely.
That you're pushed off your land.
You're quite right. The grand irony is it took decades and decades to have formal recognition to be able to go back and connect a country. And in that time, you're seeing people having to sort of think twice about how they might spend time on that country because so much has changed, both in the ecosystem, if it's become wild and the weeds have come in or you've got feral pigs, that kind of thing. But then also just whether or not physically you are able to spend time in the country because of the climate. And certainly in the future, I think that's something that obviously difficult to talk about in general terms because it depends on the community, what type of time they want to spend on the country and how they want to manage that and the resources available to them. But it does seem very unfair that in many places so much work has gone back to, that's gone into being able to go back to country, and then in the future that could be limited. And that's not just actual physical impact on humans, that's unfortunately on ecosystems. So, for example, the wetlands up in Kakadu, where you're seeing salt inundation coming in from those coastal areas, and that affects the wetlands, that's going to affect a lot of the bush tucker, because what people would want to traditionally go and hunt and would know where to go look for it, that may well have changed because of the salt impact in those areas.
Yeah, right.
It brings
so,
sorry to sound all doom and gloom about it, but
well, it is a bad picture. There's not many.
I think we need to make the problem clear, so people really want to rise up and actually tell people that this is not okay and something needs to be done.
I do want to go into the Torres Strait actually, but I had a question to follow up that, but I might come back to it. But you have worked a lot up in the Torres Strait, as you were saying before, and I know I have read previous things. It's very hard to see in reality the rising sea levels, but I guess it's exacerbated by sort of those intense weather events where you see the king tides getting bigger and encroaching on sort of low-lying islands. Can you tell me a little bit about how climate change is affecting the Torres Strait right now?
Absolutely. You can actually see it, as it were. There's sort of two main components, what's called slow-onset sea level rise, and that's the gradual increase every year. And then what sometimes can be the straw that breaks the camel's back, as it were, an increase in a storm tide. So if you get slow-onset sea level rise plus a king tide, which is a regular event, I mean, that's just a tidal event where you get a high tide, but plus a storm surge, and that could occur because of this increase in extreme events, extreme weather events.
So it's like a catastrophic intersection of these patterns.
Yeah, it's a bad combination. So you can actually look at the Bureau of Meteorology puts out tide gauge or tide warnings for beginning of January and usually in the middle of August each year, where you know you're going to get the big tides. And if you've got bad weather pattern around that time, you can kind of get a sense if that's likely to be when you're going to start to see more inundation on those islands, especially on particular coasts at particular times of year. So people can, to some degree, be prepared for it. But on many of the low-lying islands, so Saibo and Boigu, for example, they're already, you know, at break point with those sea walls, and they have to rebuild them, and they have to kind of pull infrastructure back from the seawalls. They have to turn off their sewerage pumps because they don't want to risk them getting, essentially having water forced in them the wrong way and burning the pumps out when the water's coming in over the walls and onto the roads and into the infrastructure. So it's really, at the moment, they're just trying to fill in the gaps in terms of what they can do to manage to stay there as long as possible and to try and work out what type of adaptation activities they can take for a planned future retreat or a relocation of families. It's a very sensitive topic for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But that's a reality, not just for the Torres Strait, but for Pacific Islanders too. Obviously, it's something that you'd like to think that Australia would be taking a very forward approach to our neighbours, but we're not the Pacific, and to be honest, I don't think we're really dealing with the Torres Strait very well either.
No, and I remember that comment from Peter Dutton, who jokingly talked about Pacific neighbours washing up, or some joking about climate change and rising sea levels in PNG. So
yeah,
when you hear comments like that, you sort of see where they stand in relation to politics, I guess.
Well, the grand irony is that the Torres Strait Islands are doing an absolutely incredible service to the rest of mainland Australia, just sort of being the eyes and the ears up there because it's a permeable border. We've got lots of boats crossing around that region. There's an awful lot of potential for vector-borne diseases to come down through Cape York and into Queensland. And so having people actively there and monitoring what's going on, even from a very selfish white Australia point of view, as it were, would be worth doing, absolutely worth doing. So I find it crazy to think that the government's just essentially seems to turn a blind eye. I remember when I started working there, the federal government basically gave me a bit of a reprimand and told me that I needed to toe the party line on what I was allowed to tell islanders, not to scare them.
Wow.
And I remember being horrified at the time, because basically I was talking to deniers. This is very early on, to be fair. Since then, that the message has changed, but I thought it was awful that I was being told that a certain group of people couldn't be told what I considered the truth. I was suggesting that IPCC projections, which I thought were very conservative and are very conservative, were appropriate to let people know, because that
and
was...
And even that was considered to be too scary to tell.
That was considered too scary. Yep. I was told I shouldn't be saying that because they hadn't been confirmed at the time, which was not true. So it's a very difficult area, and it's a real shame that Torres Strait Islanders will essentially be the canary in the coal mine for this, for Australia, because, you know, that unfortunately their cultural ties probably won't mean a lot to politicians unless there's votes associated with them, and votes in swing states and, you know, that kind of thing.
In the marginal seats of Sydney, who probably don't know where Torres Strait is. Yeah, it's very sad.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that leads us into, another area of your research, which is the impacts, and we've talked a little bit about it previously, about the impacts on health. And I think when you look at that Western political view, you've written about the differences in the way we view Indigenous health and Western health. Can you tell me a little bit about those differences and why, I guess, current health policy is failing Aboriginal communities?
I'm certainly not the expert to speak for Indigenous people about how they see their health, but my understanding is that the Western perspective is obviously very much based on individual health, rather than looking at a more holistic perspective or integrating that into their community or their mental state or their psychosocial well-being, it's called. And my experience of Indigenous people telling me about how they feel about their health, it's always intimately linked with how they feel in their place in their community, how strong the community is, and how that's linked back to their country. So from that perspective, I think Western science or Western health is an awful lot to learn from the original Australians, because they basically got it right. And it's a shame that we really are almost only beginning to pick that up relatively late in the day in Western medicine, but I guess that's just the way things are.
Because there's been, and I know you've cited them before, there's been several studies which show that being close to country and exercising your sort of traditional land management, that actually helps Aboriginal health and wellbeing, doesn't it? I mean, it's a valid, there's been a lot of studies to attest to this. It's not just sort of anecdotal accounts. There's actually a lot of evidence behind this.
Yes, and I think that's, if you think in a common sense way, that's actually probably understandable for more than just Aboriginal people. So if you talk to farmers about how they feel about their land and how comfortable they feel about working closely with the land, if it's, you know, in sync and things are going well, you do get a better mental state. And if you're feeling good about things, your body actually puts out different chemicals. So you are healthier in a physical sense. So those two connections are very clear. And also internationally, it's not just in Australia, people have looked at these connection. So yes, it's very important to have people on country, and one of the things that can be useful is actually in northern Australia, where we get an awful lot of carbon going to the atmosphere when there's a big bushfire, people can actually become part of the reduction of carbon, the reduction of the problem by instigating carbon management and get paid by the government to do burning, which is something that would want to do on country, to clean country and to make sure that the right plants are growing and the right animals get encouraged to come back. So they can be part of this larger movement to actually try and do something that's beneficial about for climate change by working back on their country. This is very early days, but in Australia, some of that work has really been spearheaded in really interesting ways in northern Australia.
It's interesting because a lot of it, I mean, we have sort of a revitalization of this knowledge, Indigenous knowledges around land management, when you look at a lot of works like Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe and The Greatest Estate on Earth. So I think a lot of Aboriginal peoples are trying to get back that knowledge. But I just wonder the impact of climate change on land, on ecosystems, that's actually going to change that knowledge, isn't it? It feels like we're going to lose stuff, knowledge, really important knowledges that we're only now starting to revitalize again. It seems to be completely taken out of our hands yet again because of, I was reading a lot about how the changes in ecosystems, in species, in sort of totemic species as well, how that's going to change through climate change, if that makes sense?
Absolutely. And it's one of the saddest things to know that some of the elders I've worked with have passed away now. And you could tell there were absolutely libraries of information about how animals would interact with plants and the right way to deal with things and proper things to do on country. And if that information isn't being passed on, it's lost. But then there's, as you point out, this additional complication that that information may no longer be completely correct for the ecosystem of the near future, for the next 10 or 20 years, when the climate changes and those plants and animals are going to be doing different things or new invasive species are coming in. So it is horribly complex, but I guess one heartening thing I have is Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders, to a degree, have lived here for so long and adapted to change that it is obviously possible. Unfortunately, the changes we're seeing in the ecosystems over the next 10, 20 or 30 years will be happening much more rapidly than in the past. So whether or not the same sort of adaptation strategies will be possible, to be honest, it's unlikely, especially with colonisation over the last couple of hundred years. It's really obviously very negatively affected many Indigenous people. So there's sort of multiple problems that they're having to surmount at the same time. And unfortunately, climate is just yet another problem. And that's something that I think is really important to emphasise, is that I would hope that no one would try and overemphasise climate up and up beyond all the other things that Indigenous people are trying to fight for.
Yeah, you can't really look at it in silos. I was just going to say it's a compounding problem because it obviously is on top of so many other problems in communities.
Yeah, and indirectly it can exacerbate so many of those problems as well. And I think that's the insidious kind of aspect of it, is you can just look at something that is a headline, the heat wave or the temperature increase, but then you can just look at all those multiple indirect ways that will end up affecting a community and their health and their land and indirectly all sorts of things. And that's where it gets really difficult and messy, really, because it's hard to explain and it's hard to evaluate in that sense how important it is. Although I would emphasise that really, ideally, to some degree, using climate as a trigger to make different changes in how people behave, not just in Aboriginal communities, but all over Australia, is part of the solution. We have to live differently. Mm. We can live differently. We can be much more efficient with what we do. You know, if we can convince our governments that we really don't want them to be run by the fossil fuel companies, that we have alternatives we can put in, that can make a real difference. And really, we have no choice, because if we don't start doing that and start doing that very soon, the climate change that's already locked in from the fossil fuels we've burnt will mean it will be a very uncomfortable future for our kids and our grandchildren.
When is there a point of no return? Are we reaching it soon, or have we already sort of passed it?
I think anyone that could give you an answer for certain on that would be a very valuable person and possibly naive. It's impossible to know.
Yeah.
Everyone always, especially in the negotiations, wants to tell you it's coming up really soon, to give you the opportunity to sort of say we can do something about it. It may be coming up soon. It may have passed. What we can know, though, is that there's things that we can do to reduce the problem in the future, and that's the reality. We don't have another Earth to go to check out whether or not, you know, if we'd done it a bit faster, it would have helped, or if we had the opportunity to slow things down, we're still okay.
Yeah.
We need to be taking action now. Another climate scientist recently said, well, actually, we should have been taking action 30 years ago. We certainly should have. We knew the problem was there 30 years ago. The upside is that we can see different places around the world starting to take action and realising that different ways of doing things are possible. The international agreements in Paris at the end of last year were quite good in that respect. They were some of the strongest ones that have been brought in internationally, which is signalling for markets to really emphasise, for example, using renewable technologies, getting away from fossil fuels. But I think it's a slow and painful process. For example, in Queensland with the coal mines that we've seen, or even down south in the Latrobe Valley, coal mines again is an issue. These guys won't give up easily. And that's a real problem, because we cannot afford to dig up and either ship overseas to burn or burn ourselves the amount of coal reserves we have in Australia. It's too big.
Yeah, I was
that
just going to say,
definitely put us over the edge.
Exporting coal is the big problem at the moment, isn't it? We're sort of offloading our problems to other countries, but we're still going to get hit with the brunt.
Yeah, we're in a global system, so yes, if they burn it somewhere else, it will end up hurting us. Yeah.
Now, you did that study, I think I referred to it before, it was sort of a big, wide-ranging study into the effects of climate change on the tropical north. I was just wondering, I mean, it's one of the only studies, I don't know, there probably are other studies, but it seemed to be one of the only studies I could find about how it's going to affect Aboriginal populations specifically. I'm just wondering if you ever got a response from that report from government or what actually happened after that was published.
Sure, typically it wasn't just me. There was a large writing team. And in addition to that large writing team, we actually insisted at the beginning of the report that the government allow us to include Aboriginal writers to do the case studies on Torres Strait Islanders. I don't know. Well, it could have been one of those timing things. I remember at the end of the report, which I'm sure many people who work with government departments know, there was a lot of fighting about words that would be included in the final report before it would be allowed to be published under a government auspice. I'd like to think that it raised the awareness up north. I didn't see any direct response. There were recommendations in that report. Government acknowledged it as an issue. But, you know, not long after that, the Department of Climate Change got disbanded with the federal government.
Of course.
And those are the people that promoted the research. So, unfortunately, we went into a climate change denier dark period in government. And not only were the impacts of climate in Northern Australia on Indigenous people ignored, but they really were for everyone else in Australia too. I know in the Torres Strait they did a good job at the federal level pushing to get adaptation funding really over the last couple of years, and that has been on again and off again. But I know it's extraordinarily difficult to actually get movement up there and to get funding for really needed adaptation activities. So I'd say certainly not enough response. And I haven't seen any significant reports as a follow-up from that one. And as far as I'm aware, you're right, that was the first one.
You're probably like one of the very few actual climate scientists who are working directly in relation to Aboriginal communities, are you? I mean, I'm not aware of many others.
In Northern Australia, I think there would be now. When I started, I would say that was definitely the case because I was coming across other scientists who would maybe work in allied areas, so someone who might look at changes in ecosystems, for example. And some of those changes might be related to changes in climate, but they weren't linking them up directly. And if they were in the north, by almost definition, they were probably on Aboriginal land. So they may be working with Aboriginal people. There are some people working at JCU, so in Queensland or Charles Darwin, based in the Northern Territory, so academics who are working in related areas. It's a difficult area, though, for most straight climate scientists because they've got no training at all in the kinds of things they would need to be able to work in Northern Australia with Aboriginal people. Climate science, in a sense, is a relatively new field. Many people come out of maths or physics. And you can imagine that those people aren't necessarily in a good position to really understand the complexities of the problem about how that might translate to very different setting in Northern Australia.
Yeah, right.
So it's a tricky area for people to get trained up and to work in. And I think for me it was really almost luck with that exposure in the States with the environmental justice communities to realise there were other dimensions to the problem than just the straightforward how much will the temperature rise by a certain time in the future.
I just wonder when we're focusing on the North, there was that, I don't know if you know much about it, but there was that white paper into developing the North released, I think it was last year, but it had no sort of talk about Aboriginal. Yeah, nothing about climate change, but also nothing about Aboriginal people really, even though we hold most of the land up there. Does that, when you see things like that, I get those sort of white papers that focus on development and it seems to leave climate change completely out of it. I guess what's your sort of reaction to plans like that?
Again, I wouldn't want to profess I'm an expert in the area. My limited experience with that kind of report is, don't they come out every 5 or maybe 10 years? They talk about the grand plan to, you know, put in huge types of new irrigation or new infrastructure and totally transform the north, and something may or may not happen and huge amounts of money get splashed around, possibly without actually asking any of the local people whether or not that was a smart thing to do or whether someone didn't try and do that 10 years ago.
And sounds about right. That is a good sum up of it, I reckon.
So that's what, you know, anecdotally I understand to be true. And, you know, I guess that's one of the issues of when policies get decided in Canberra and then brought forth and dropped down in areas that really you're talking, they're not even talking to the right people, that they're not even bothering to talk. It's just a need to push something out. So not too optimistic, I'm afraid.
It feels like we can never talk optimistically about this, can we? But I was going to ask you also about the coral bleaching in the Torres Strait, because obviously mm-hmm. there was those really shocking reports about 90% of the reef. I was going to ask you about sort of how does climate change, I guess, impact that? Why does it lead to coral bleaching? And I guess how is it going to affect particularly people who live off the sea, Aboriginal peoples, who sort of are around the Great Barrier Reef, who that's their traditional country as well, and I guess they use it for fishing and everything like that. I just wanted to ask you specifically about the ties between climate change and coral bleaching.
Yeah, so sea surface temperature, which is where the corals like to be because they like to get the sunlight to be able to grow. We know sea surface temperature increases in particular times. So this season right now with the El Niño, where you're getting these warm surface waters coming across, and we think that those temperatures are slightly higher than they would be because of climate, the waters around the corals. And the corals don't like it when it gets a little bit warmer. They get to a crucial point where they actually can't live anymore. So they expel the little animals that live within them and they bleach. And that's what you see as a result is actually the dead coral is why it looks white. Corals do bleach naturally anyway because this occurrence would happen with natural variability, so nothing to do with climate. But they will probably bleach very infrequently.
Yeah, right. And not like what we're seeing now.
Yes. So one of the problems is they can't recover quickly enough. So if it's a very occasional bleaching event and it's a patchy bleach, so you'll get corals being able to recolonize in areas where they might have been bleached in the past, if that's happening infrequently in a cycle, then a recovery is possible. And I think one of the alarm bells for climate scientists would be that what we're likely to see is an increase in these sea surface temperatures more regularly, and more regularly to a point that the corals can't recover because they actually have to adapt to a different average temperature. And if they're not used to that and they can't make that change fast enough, they're not going to recover. So either essentially people have to get involved and they have to try and relocate corals that are used to warmer waters, which is one thing that people are trying to do. But obviously that will change the ecosystem of the fish and all the other marine life around those corals. All that area will start dying.
Yeah, right.
So there's obvious... We'll definitely say something optimistic in a minute, but unfortunately this bit isn't optimistic. If people are used to a certain group of marine species or the ecosystem, that's likely to change the future because there's not much we can do about that changing sea surface temperature. It really is one of the things we can see that will be increasing over time, and it's going to be a slow build and we won't be able to halt that anytime soon.
So I know Torres Strait Islanders particularly are very dependent on the sea. That will obviously impact, coral bleaching obviously impacts their livelihood as well and their ability, their food security as well, because it's often very hard to get fresh food up there.
Mm. One thing I do remember, like most of the Torres Strait is that they do a great job of gardening. We always get some interesting veggies and herbs to go with the fresh fish. But yes, the question would be which fresh fish should they be pulling out the sea and whether or not the harvest of that fish will be affected. Of course, you've got to remember this also is impacted by other things, nothing to do with climate. For example, overfishing, illegal fishing, just changes in fish stocks will make a massive difference, and climate is an element which will compound those problems. So we really also have to look at bigger government policy issues around sustainable fishing in that region further north. You know, that reports of illegal fishing going on and taking stuff that rightfully is the islanders and possibly not having enough ability to regulate or control that process.
So it's like we have to
at the end
start
of the day, yes, it is likely to get harder to have some good fish out there.
So it's interesting. It seems like we don't, I mean, when we talk, particularly in Aboriginal affairs, I mean, I talk about a lot of issues and a lot of it, sometimes it has to do with culture and heritage and environment, but I think we have to start including climate change as a factor in a lot of the things we talk about, even in regards to health, because it strikes me as it's always going to be that compounding factor, even if it's not a direct cause, it's going to exacerbate it. And I don't think we think about climate change in every area of Aboriginal affairs, but I think just talking to you, it's going to be a factor in a lot of different areas that we don't even think it will impact.
Yeah, and you couldn't be more right. I mean, to be honest, I think it would be hard for you to suggest a topic that I couldn't link to climate.
Yeah.
Climate change indirectly will impact every area of our lives, and that's why it's so vital that every area of our lives, and this is the optimistic bit, we work out how we can do differently, because there are many ways we can, both Aboriginal islanders, people down in Canberra, we can do things differently, and we have to, as a nation, as Australia, decide we will be doing things differently. And the faster we get to that point, both at the individual level, but also, very importantly, by pushing for change at the governmental level, we'll actually start to see some real progress. I know previously you've interviewed people from the Seed Summit.
Yeah.
And it's just fabulous to see that Indigenous youth getting up and saying enough and really taking on particular topics and particular issues and integrating how they see they want the climate issue dealt with in their local context. That's fabulous. I mean, that just so didn't exist 10 years ago when I was working in this space. So I was really heartened to see so many people from all over Australia really knowing their issues, knowing their stuff, and knowing what they wanted done about it. Because that's the thing, you don't just want to describe the problem.
Yeah.
You need to describe the problem and then present a solution and then really just nail home the fact that you're not going to go away until that solution is put in place.
Do you think there's enough, talking about solutions, I guess is there sort of that emerging green economy, is there sort of enough opportunities for Aboriginal people to begin working back on their land and begin being part of that solution as well in managing land?
I'd hope so. I know the Ranger program is not funded well enough, but you're getting to see people working out, for example, with turtle and dugong monitoring, sorting out ghost nets, you know, the traditional burning, monitoring, ecosystems, all that kind of thing. But, I mean, how much potential is there? It's massive. I don't think we've even begun to tap the smallest amount of that. And to give people employment doing what they should be doing, which is managing country, just seems like a fabulous way to go.
Yeah.
So I really don't think that has been taken on at the level it should be. And so what I mean is add a few more zeros onto whatever it was they were thinking of funding, not, you know, stuffing around with a small percentage. Make massive change in that area, because that's one way that you could really start investing in people and their land and let people make decisions for themselves about how they want to manage that land. And obviously, if they need advice in a Western science sense about, well, you know, how might it be best to burn, or to look at some projections and make decisions in what areas they'd want to prioritise, then that option is there. But really give people the power and the resources and the knowledge to be able to make those decisions for themselves.
Most definitely. And I think one of the great things about the Seed Mob and this sort of emergence of young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders in this movement is the fact that they're giving voice to another alternative other than just mining. Because I think the current sort of framing of the debate in Aboriginal communities is about economic development. Like, it's binary, economic development versus sort of caring for your country, when there's obviously a completely different issue. I think there's important voices that have to be raised around you can actually make a living on working on your country as well. I think there's been a lot of propaganda around all this mining and the benefits it can bring to communities. So I guess that's another way we can break
through. Absolutely. It's horrible. I mean, the government basically, in collusion with corporations, frequently blackmail Aboriginal communities.
Yep.
Because if you don't say yes to the mine, well, you won't get these services.
Well, pretty much they can do it anyway, if you look at Adani and what they're doing up there. So
absolutely. The government would never be able to get away with doing that somewhere else in a non-Aboriginal community. It would be outrageous, in the government's substitution of services, but that's a regular occurrence. And we know that to be true. We're like, that's documented. So it really saddens me when companies go in promising huge levels of local employment and all the different services that they'll provide. And then once it's signed off, people or communities find that only some of those promises are met.
Yeah.
And frequently what's not discussed is the amount of pollution and health problems that will result for many generations in the future as a result of that mine going in.
Yeah, definitely.
Or whatever the processing plant is. And that's something that is very badly, very weakly controlled, if regulated at all. And that's an aspect that's hidden until it's too late, because really once it's too late, you know, the effects of a mining dam or tailings dam downstream, for example, it's just profound on country, and you can't put it back. You can't ever put that land back where it should be.
I was going to say, there's that big lie about rehabilitation. It never actually works that way, does it?
Well, and this is without climate. So when they're building those tailings dams, or when they've done them in the past, they haven't considered the impact of, for example, the extreme events we were talking would increase because of climate change. So if you're going to see, a big downpour that maybe would only occur once in 100 years, because of climate, that might occur one in 10 years. And so if a tailings dam is nearly full of some toxic product and you get a big downpour, it overtops, which means it runs over into the local environment, down through the stream systems, and you get nasty toxic chemicals running all over the place, and that goes into the fish that bioaccumulates, that goes into the people that eat the fish. That's well known. And people currently aren't thinking about that.
No.
And they're not required to think about that by government. So it's very short-term thinking. That's even before the rehab happens, as it were. Yeah.
I was just going to say, it just reminds me of the McArthur River mine up there. I think the local mob on the Borroloola, actually, their lead levels in the fish are quite toxic at the moment, and they've basically lost a lot of the rights to their country just from that mine being on their traditional country, and a lot of that country is ruined already, and there's no turning back.
Yes, we recently were lucky to have a presentation by some of the people going down to the Glencore AGM about that very issue. And the solution to having cattle in that area who have high level of toxins in them was to shoot the cattle.
That was the solution. It's all Band-Aids, isn't it?
It's just unbelievable. And unfortunately, as with other leaded communities in Australia, Borroloola is just a little bit too far away. It's very difficult to get information out, so it's quite early days for people to even start believing how bad the problem is there.
Right.
So the other communities, also with higher Aboriginal populations than average, for example, in Port Pirie or Mount Isa or Broken Hill, they've had years, or really decades and decades, trying to deal with this problem, and so there's a lot more information available where people have gone up and actually done sampling and done testing. Around the McArthur River mine, it's just... I mean, unfortunately, it seems like a really bad joke, the amount of information that those communities are allowed access to.
Yeah, right.
So hopefully that will change in the near future with some of the work they're doing at the moment. But, yeah, it's a very new problem, and I don't even think people have been able to adequately describe the size of it, because they either don't know or it's hidden, but it's not because the problem isn't there.
And I guess it's just so enormous, it's very hard to grapple with as well.
Yeah, so just the official government source of pollution, so the National Pollution Inventory, if people want to look at the npi.gov.au, every year puts out information about where the most different types of pollution are put out by industry every year. And for the first year this year, the emissions of lead from the McArthur River mine topped the tables that beat even Mount Isa.
God.
If you looked at the MPI figures. And it's difficult because one of the things I'm looking into is just how those are calculated. But just to give you a sense, or your listeners a sense of scale, no one's got close to Mount Isa before. So,
wow, so this is huge.
Yeah, that's something that really, it would be wise to focus on what is coming out of that mine, because the local environment and the people who want to live in that environment are very likely to be impacted unless controls are put in place.
I just think of the mental health of the mob up there too, because when you talk about Mount Isa, a lot of them mob out Mount Isa have connections to areas like in Borroloola and all through Gulf Country and everything like that. So I know that a lot of these are, you know, hurting the land like this and taking control out of the hands of our people. It actually hurts us mentally as well. And I was reading a little bit about PTSD in your studies as well, and how those stresses could lead to sort of more traumatic experiences for a lot of mob. And I listen to this and it makes me really sad. I can only imagine what the effect it has on people actually living on this country. I don't think we realise fully the impact it's going to have psychologically on a people who are so traumatised already.
Yes, I haven't. I think there was probably someone else who did the psychosocial studies. That wasn't myself, but I do know some of the work you're talking about. All I can say is the one upside is the youth that I've seen come down to say that things are not right seem incredibly strong and incredibly motivated to make change. And that's one really powerful response, because if you feel like you're going to be able to make a difference and your voice will be heard when you go, for example, a company AGM to insist change needs to happen, mentally, hopefully, that's giving you some strength, because you realise that there's some movement that you're starting to build rather than just sitting there and letting it happen to you. And clearly that mob want things to change. So I'm really, really hoping that, in the next short term we start to see some change from Glencore. I know globally they're not doing so well at the moment, either financially or in a PR sense. So hopefully their contribution to that global effort will make a difference.
I think that's a great way to end it, on the strength of our people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, because I think this is a very doom and gloom subject, obviously, but I think you ended it perfectly about the strength and resilience of our mob. So thank you so much for that, Don. Wake up.